This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, do you want to meet Nadia Hussain? Let's get Nadia in here and talk to her, because Nadia is the winner of the Great British Bake Off in the sixth series. She's gone on to do amazing things. She's in South Africa with the rest of the BBC Studios team, who have a host of exciting shows coming up across all of their channels. And she's going to join us today to talk about her upcoming two-part series called Nadia's Asian Odyssey, among many other interesting things. So we can ask her about food, we can ask her about travel, we can ask her about her life in Britain up to the time that she became famous for the British Bake Off, and plenty of other stuff. My parents watch this show, they love it. Who is this? Who that old trout who's in the one of the judges or whatever her name is?
I don't know. This is actually one show I don't know too much about.
Okay, I thought you knew it.
I know of it, but I don't watch it.
I thought that was your show. Okay, sorry. So my mother and father love this Great British Bake Off. They say it's very, very entertaining. They watch it all the time. I have to be honest with you. You know this already about me. I don't know anything about cooking. I don't know anything about baking. Everything I've ever touched in a kitchen has been a disaster. So I kind of take the view that if I can't participate in these things, I don't take any interest. But I'm really, really happy that you're here in South Africa, because I know that there are three things that people cannot get enough of in television and in books, and that is baking, cooking, and religion. And we're going to focus on baking this morning, but it's really nice to see you, Nadia, and thank you for coming to talk to us.
Thank you.
First of all, I mean, I know it's many, many years later, but congratulations on your win and all the things that you've done since. Are you excited about your new show?
Yeah, when you kind of list all the things that I've done, it kind of, my mind just whirs. I can't believe, like, so because it's so much has happened in
bit
4 years.
Bit of a roller coaster, huh?
Yeah, and you were saying about you not cooking. You sound just like my husband, by the way.
Oh, really?
Is a dreadful cook.
Yeah, I ruin everything. I can't do an egg properly.
Yeah, you're definitely like my husband. The last time he cooked, he boiled 5 eggs, and then the only way he remembered that he had eggs boiling on the cooker was when there was this loud bang, and then
something
all
exploded.
The eggs were on the ceiling.
Yeah, it sounds familiar. Well, Gord's excited because he's fat. Look, I mean,
yes,
he loves baking.
I love food. I love to only eat anything that's indulgent and fat. I have no whim control whatsoever, and I only associate with other fat people. So we fat people are just, to us, you are really the evangelists of our lives. Without people that can cook spectacularly good food, there'd be no joy or interest whatsoever in my life as a fat human being. So you're more than just an entertaining, informative, talented lady. To me, you're an icon.
So, Nadia, just ignore him. He's really not important.
No, this is definitely the new type of radio for me.
He's really
definitely.
Not.
I've never done anything like this before.
He's not even important.
Either of us.
Oh, because I brought it up. Hey, go.
He's not important. He's here once a week when he decides to come. So please don't let him. Let's make it about him. He always tries to make it about him. Really,
hey, listen, I like to cook, and he likes to eat. I reckon it's a great partnership.
I was minding my goddamn business. I was just
Nadia,
listening.
Tell me about this Asian Odyssey. This sounds like an exciting thing to do. Now, Asia is an enormous continent.
Yes.
And people say Asian, and sometimes what they mean is like Southeast Asian. Sometimes they mean Indian. Sometimes they mean Pakistani. Sometimes they mean Japanese. It's all very different. I mean,
yeah.
You can't go everywhere, right?
No, it's big, isn't it? It's varied. So, I mean, what made me go to Asia? What made me do this Asian Odyssey? I was really curious about my DNA, and so this is
you're originally Bangladeshi heritage, right?
Yeah. So my family are from Bangladesh. My parents are immigrants, and we grew up. We were all born in the UK, so we'd go back to Bangladesh every single year. But it was something. Because back in Bangladesh, we don't have a census. You know, you're born in the village, you work in the village, you die in the village. That's it. There is no history. They don't have birth certificates, death certificates, nothing.
Wow.
So
there's no way to trace any kind of family
nothing.
Story there.
No one at all, or just the people in like the more rural parts?
In the rural parts,
okay.
There are no. I mean, now I think there's a system where there are birth certificates and death certificates, but certainly not for my granddad, who, you know, died in his, you know, he was in his 90s. And he was born in that village. He died in that village, and that village was him and his four brothers. So there was nothing. I had nothing. And I was kind of like envious of people who do these DNA tests and find this amazing information out. I thought, right. So and under I think the one thing that really led me to do the DNA test is a complete vanity. Like under my headscarf, I have big black curly hair, and I thought, I've got to be African. I've got to be. That's what it was. I was like, I've got to be from Africa, surely. And so I did the DNA test, and it came back that I was part Thai, part Cambodian, and part Nepalese.
That's so cool to be varied. I had that test done. I don't know if it was vanity, but it was also just kind of like a huge curiosity. I was really hoping that in and amongst all this pasty whiteness, there was like some little trace of something cool. Like, oh, dude, you got like 3% like Ethiopian DNA, something like cool and
nothing,
interesting.
Right?
Just a blend of the whitest kinds of white. It's amazing that I'm
European.
Even able. It's amazing I'm even able to watch dancing. Like I'm mostly like UK with a bit of Teutonic and a bit of East European, and just horribly white.
Did you do one of those mouth swab ones where you send them away and then they come back with a breakdown?
Yeah.
That's fascinating stuff. Yeah. So you said Cambodian, Vietnamese,
Cambodian, Thai, and Nepalese.
Oh wow!
Yeah, which was a massive shock for me. I was not expecting that at all. And those are the kind of Thailand was one of those places that was. It was kind of one of the places that I would have loved to visit one day, and it was just there on a list of places that we'd like to go. But Cambodia and Nepal certainly were not on the list. So I took a map out once I'd got it, and I remember sort of reading the emails. All right, I got to go and get a world map out. Sat down and looked at kind of where Thailand, Cambodia, and Nepal sit where in terms of Bangladesh. Yeah. And I can understand, like, in somebody from somewhere must have traveled and then ended up and settled in Bangladesh. And it was really funny because I was sat with my kids, and my son was like, "I'm sure it's a love story. Do you think somebody from Cambodia fell in love with somebody in Nepal and then they decided they'd run away and live in Bangladesh?" I was like, "That sounds so elaborate,
mysterious." You've got Cambodia with those jungles and
Angkor Wat. Knows a lot about
Angkor Wat.
And you've got Nepal, which is up in the Himalayas.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you. You're quite historically literate, Gareth. Like, has there been a lot of interaction between those nations? I asked a question.
What is your question?
Has there historically been a lot of interaction between those different countries?
Yeah, I mean, they are geographically all more or less in the same. I mean, they're quite spread out. But Southeast Asia, you've got Bangladesh, which is, downstream from Nepal, effectively.
Yeah.
Cambodia is a bit of a trek, but it's there. It's not out of the question that someone could have, either in the last 100, 200, 300 years, made massive moves in that area. But it is interesting what you said about your grandfather. He was born in that village, died in that village. People didn't really tend to move around too much.
No.
To have all these diverse inheritances is quite something.
It is, and certainly isn't for, because my granddad stayed in the village, but my dad then moved out and he came to the UK, which means that somebody had to make that move, and somebody before my granddad made that move. And it was really interesting for me because it wasn't just about because I knew that once I'd got that DNA test, I couldn't do very much else. That was it for me. So at that point, I thought, right, what do I want out of this DNA test? And so I thought, right, I'm going to travel and I want to see what kind of foods they eat, because really that's the only thing that's going to ever link me, because I'm never going to get anything else. That's it. I've done the DNA test. I've only got one grandparent left and she's back in Bangladesh. So I'd have to turn up with a swab and swab her and see if I can get any more. And I don't think she's going to let me anywhere near her mouth. She's like, no. But I'd have to swab her. But it just, for me, that's it. After doing that DNA test, I knew I can't get very much else. So the only thing I could do is travel and see what kind of food they eat and see if I could link the food to the food that I grew up with at home. And that, for me, was the most interesting bit.
So tell me a little bit about these different kinds, because Cambodian food, I don't know anything about. Thai food is obviously very, very interesting, and there's a huge diversity of flavors and influences and things there. And Nepalese, I'm also not 100% familiar with. Bangladeshi food is very interesting.
Yeah.
So what did you pick up immediately? Because going there, obviously, is part of the experience, and maybe you tried to imagine what these ancestors of yours were doing.
Yeah, well, what you do is you kind of... The first thing you do is go on the internet and see what's the best thing to eat when you're out in Cambodia. And something that came up quite often was something called prahok, which is a fermented fish. And that is very, we grew up eating fermented fish. And these days, no, don't say that.
I got to know, how hungry was the first person that was like, right, guys, all that's left. You know, we accidentally let that one fish ferment. All that's left is that. It's that or death. And like one oak was like, okay, cool, I'm going to eat the fermented fish. Screw this.
If it's that or death, then you're going to eat the fermented fish, aren't you?
Yeah, oysters probably got first eaten as well.
How do you, what does it taste like? What is it, how do you make it?
Well, in Bangladesh, they so they take the little fish that they can't do very much with, very bony little fish that you can't really eat, and they stick it into dry bamboo shoots, and then plug it, and then stick it in the ground for 3 months, take it out, and then use it to cook. No!
How can you eat, bury a fish, then exhume it, and then eat it? I mean, I'm not
an exhumed fish.
I'm purely thinking in terms of the fact that, like, when fish goes bad, fish cause you real problems.
But these days, everyone tells you to eat fermented food. It's a big thing now.
Sure.
Everyone says eat
gut health and all the rest. But
probiotic,
I mean, I'm not like judging it. I'm fascinated that that can be a hygienic thing to do with a fish.
But what does it taste like?
Have you ever had shrimp paste before?
No.
Never.
Is that a bit
I told you I'm a philistine when it comes to anything. I'm not a foodie. I don't understand. I'm not experimental. Thai food
I'm
I like.
Interested in shrimp paste. Also,
what
I
is shrimp paste?
Is it anything like our local red row or fish paste? I suppose you probably haven't had.
Do you ever? If you ever have Thai food, there's this kind of strong, quite strong, like fish sauce. Okay. Have you ever had fish sauce before?
No, but I get.
Why
the
am I even
I get
here?
I get the Thai shrimp
talking
stock.
To morons.
Get the Thai shrimp stock and cook with it sometimes.
But
it's very nice.
So it gives you that really kind of, it gives you a really
mega
strong
fish
fishy flavor. And that's kind of what it's like. It's like a, it's like fish sauce, but slightly stronger. Now you imagine you turn up with a crew. I'm used to this smell. So because my mum cooks it all the time. I cook it in my house at least once a week. I cook it in the garage actually because it stinks the kitchen out. So I go in the garage and stick the portable cooker on, and then the neighbours can have a waft, but it's not in my house. I'm like, here you go, neighbours, have a smell. It smells, it stinks, but you can't get the smell out for months. So when my mum cooks it, I'm like, Mum, open a window.
I'm still waiting for upside. I'm stuck.
But it's really good for you. And when I went out there, that's something that they cook in Nepal, in Cambodia. It's prahok. And when we were out there, we were in on a fishing village.
Yeah.
And it was a floating village. So all their houses are on the river, just suspended, just on the water. And they're just kind of bobbing. But they live on these, like, so you've got your living room bobbing in one place. And then if you want to move your kitchen, you can just untie your kitchen and kind of move it around to the other side. So it's like
so
these,
they don't bother each other with the smells.
Yeah, I mean,
of
like, if
kitchens.
You don't like your neighbor, you just like, let yourself
sail
go
you
and
just,
sail
like,
off.
Row the kitchen to a more convenient spot.
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty cool.
Exactly. But it's. When we went there, you could see, and this they were known for making the best prahok, and they you could see little kind of like these little bobbing islands, and they've got the fish just drying. So they do it differently. They don't stick it in the ground. They salt it and they let it dry. And there's this smell in the air. But for me, it was the smell. It smelled like what my mum would cook.
Sure.
It's very familiar. And I, you can imagine with when you go in with a camera crew, they're like, oh, what is that smell? I'm like, that's the prahok. And I loved it. And for them, it was an unusual smell. So, yeah.
All right. So that's Cambodian.
Yeah.
Talk to me about Nepalese.
Yes. Food. So, yeah. So in the first episode, I traveled to Cambodia and Thailand in that order. And then in the second episode, I traveled to Nepal.
All right. So let me not skip ahead then. So tell me about Thailand, because we have an idea of what Thai food is, and there are there are now Thai restaurants
everywhere.
In every corner of the world.
Yeah.
Because Thai food is very, it's unexpected mix and match stuff, right? You've got peanuts and you've got chilies and you've got leaves and you've got sauces and you've got, there's a huge diversity of stuff in Thai food.
Yeah, and I think we do get to eat, I mean, I think especially back in the UK, you know, it's quite popular. There are lots
Thai
of
restaurants.
Yeah, they're popping up everywhere, and they're these kind of there's these fusion restaurants where they're kind of Thai, kind
well,
of Chinese.
I was going to ask you about Thai food because I haven't been to Thailand. I'd love to go. A lot of my friends have, and they say the food is a huge part of the experience. It's affordable, it's varied, it's amazing, and you just pick out, which obviously is the whole focus of my life, Gareth. But I noticed that when I went to Mexico City, when we wanted to go for Mexican food, they took us to a place that served very different food than what you would expect from a Mexican restaurant, a westernized Mexican restaurant. And when we explained, okay, like where are the sort of tortillas and nachos and that kind of thing, they were like, oh, American Mexican food. Literally, we were like, oh, yes, there's an American Mexican restaurant. And even the Mexican people go for that experience, to have the American Mexican food experience, because it's not what they usually eat. And what they would eat normally is like a more sort of cold and coleslaw-ish kind of sauerkraut-y pickled cold pork sort of wrap things, as opposed to your like guacamole. Anyway, I wanted to know whether the West, we have also a lot of those westernized Thai restaurants here. Is the food quite far removed from what you programmed or used to in Western culture.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. When you go to Thai restaurants back in the UK, it's, you know, they are, like most restaurants, they are kind of fitted to the Western palate. So, you know, they something like a fish sauce is really important in a pad Thai or in particular Thai recipes. But that will be taken out because the smell might be a little bit too strong for the Western palate. And so that will be taken out and certain things removed. And you know, back out in Thailand, what I was really surprised at was that they love sugar. They love to put sugar in their pad Thai, which was, I was like, no. Like, why are we, like, sprinkling sugar on our pad Thai? I'm not into that. Like, that's weird for me. But that's what they do. They, like, the best pad Thai place that we found sprinkle sugar on top of their pad Thai. But for me, that was unusual. But we travelled out to a tiny island called Koh Sakorn, which has a population of 2,000, mostly Muslims. And we went out there. And it's called, I think it's, the island is called, it's ironically called the Island of Pigs. And Muslims don't eat pigs. So there are no pigs on there either. So, but we went out there and we met this amazing group of women who didn't have jobs, you know, elderly women who kind of wanted to be a bit more, they wanted to be a bit more involved in the island and do something with themselves because with old age, they just left with nothing to do.
Just sit around, yeah.
Yeah. So they, this wonderful woman, which you'll see on that on the first episode, I meet her and she started to make her own paste. So she started to make something called grandmother's curry paste. So it was a paste that her grandma taught her and that's what she named it, grandma's curry paste. That was it. And that is, everyone on the island travels to her every morning and picks up their curry paste, which I was really shocked because there is also, even though they do everything from scratch, there is this element of, you know, like buying ready-made pastes, which is quite common in Western society. Just go out and buy ready-made curry. She was essentially doing that.
But she's also authentically making it. So it's like, on the one hand, you get that ready-made paste experience, but you get it from the most authentic person.
Yeah, that is the most, that was by far one of the most delicious things that I've ever tasted. And I still, I make the paste now, and I don't know whose grandma she is, but she's someone's grandma, and I just call it grandma's curry paste, and it's in the fridge.
Are you meticulous about following it exactly according to her recipe?
Yes.
Or do you add your own
Is
she forthcoming with the recipe?
Yeah, she was. She was. It's there. You know, it's there for you to see. Anyone who watches it will look at it, and, you know, she will just, she goes through all the ingredients, and if you want to, you could go home and make it yourself. Mm. It is a wonderful, wonderful recipe. So I was really surprised to go there and
so what do you make with it usually? Curries and that kind of thing?
Yeah, so she literally sticks a load of this paste in, a bit of coconut milk, a bit of desiccated coconut, sticks a whole chicken in.
Yeah.
Tops it with water and leaves it there for 3 hours, and then you pull all the bones out, and then it's just fragrant and delicious. Pot of rice, just so simple. That's, it's so easy. My kids do it.
God, the fat man.
You triggered me. Triggered me. As if I was hiding it away. what was there anything that like was just not for you, like that you went to try? Because obviously, I would imagine you have quite a like open-minded palate.
Yeah. So I pretty much try anything. But when we were out there, I met this really cool guy who is like I call him Doomsday Mike because he's like, he's convinced that like we eat too much chicken. And
I love
eat too
a good
much-
nickname yeah. like that. Yeah. I love a problem Dave or a Doomsday Mike.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, he was hell bent that the world is going to end, and when it does, what are we going to eat? Because there'll be no chicken or meat to eat. So what will be left is insects. So he runs this just bizarre restaurant, which is it's bizarre and cool all in the same breath. And he runs this incredible restaurant where it's insect based.
I'll put some hell on that no.
Okay.
Go and have something else.
Explain to us what does he compress, like 20,000 insects into paste, a seed bar.
Just start thinking about the paste possibilities and then your life is ruined.
No, he doesn't hide. He doesn't hide the insect.
So it's still got legs.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So when I was there, obviously, he had
this... I got a wing in my teeth.
He had a selection of insects, and he said, you know, he makes, I mean, proper nachos. He makes nachos with ant larvae.
But does he get like a traditional sort of corn or flour-based nacho and then put ant larvae in it, or does he find a way to like substitute regular baking ingredients? So that like the nacho itself is made out of like abdomen of cricket and then ant larvae.
That's a very small nacho, that is.
So what? How do they? How do they serve this? And what did you
Octown
have?
Octown prawn kebab.
So we had nachos, with I had nachos with a lovely, it had like a tomato relish salsa on top, but it was...
Where's he going to get the tomato and the nachos when doomsday happened? That's essentially where I was going with this question.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, but I think by then we're probably just going to be eating the insects. Okay. So he just...
Luxury doomsday.
Yeah.
Time.
So he just...
Nadia's trying to like be open to this. We must give her a chance to explain Is it anything that you want to repeat? Is it something that you would serve guests?
What, eating insects?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Hmm. Yeah. So it was good.
It was delicious.
Plot twist.
The crickets were delicious. I don't know that I'd eat ant larvae again. It's a little bit weird.
Yeah, it's a bit wet. That's very weird.
It's a bit wet.
It's larvae.
Yeah. I wouldn't do that again. My mum was disgusted. So my mum watched it and she looked at it and she goes, "What will the community say?" And I'm like, "Who cares what the community think?" She was disgusted.
I honestly just cannot fathom voluntarily eating ant larvae. Unless it was to save my own life from starvation.
I wouldn't do that again, but the crickets were delicious. He deep fried them, put a little bit of seasoning on top, and they were crunchy, and they were really... It's a thing now. Like, you can buy them in shops, like in fancy shops. People
so
like,
you really hit the crickets for a six on that. Well,
So, Nadia, I just want to talk about you a little bit, because you grew up in Luton, and you've got five siblings.
Yep.
And after school, you went to do your A-levels, and, you know, you studied a whole bunch of different things, and... And you married your husband, what, in 2005? So 10 years before you won the show.
Yeah, so I got married when I was 20.
Yeah?
We were quite young and we didn't have a clue. And then we had my son the following year, and then we had my son the year after that, like, seeing us not doing anything.
Went straight into it, huh?
Yeah, it's like, so seeing as we're not doing anything, should we just have children? And then we had I was looking at the seat in the car and I was like, there's an empty seat.
We could have three.
We could put a person in that. And so we had a third, and that was our reason to have a third child. And then we bought a really big car, and then I was like, he's like, no, not happening.
So three was enough.
Three was enough. And then we, my husband was the one I actually applied for Bake Off about 8 years off. Yeah, so it was about...
Was he trying to get you out of the house for a little bit?
So I suffer with panic disorder.
Really?
Yeah, so I suffer with anxiety and panic disorder. And he, I think in the 8 years that we'd been married and, you know, I was so busy with the kids, a lot of my time and my efforts were spent on looking after the kids, making sure the house was making sure the house was like perfect. And he just said, there's something about you in the 8 years that you've completely kind of almost... I've lost the person that I married. And it did consume me
You go on the show, right? So the bits I've seen, they've got a stopwatch and it's pressure.
Yeah.
And if you bake it badly and it flops, you have to start all over again.
With you.
And who's that woman, that old trout? What's her name?
I am not even going to answer that question.
But that is like a very high-pressure situation.
She's well-known. She's a really well-known...
I'm not saying it.
You've got to say it.
She's like the queen. You can't say stuff like that.
Who are the people on the show?
The judges.
Yes. And then I'll know which
Without
one.
Without
judgment.
Mary Berry.
Mary Berry. So Mary Berry, she's the delightful lady, right?
Lovely
lady. No, she really is. She's a delightful lady. She's very sweet. She loves all of the world of baking and plenty more. She's very well... known in Britain. She's knowledgeable about a number of different things. But she is quite a difficult person to please when it comes to the Great British Bake Off. And the other judges aren't that easy either. So when you're under pressure like this with your panic disorder...
Yeah.
Was your husband trying to punish you? This is terrible. What a thing to do to your wife that you supposedly love.
Yeah, I think he thought I needed to come out of my comfort zone. And my children and my husband, they are my comfort blanket. And I think he knew that. And he just said, look, it's all or nothing. You just do it and see what happens. I mean, there were points when I felt like it was going to kill me. It was really, really difficult. And anyone who's watched the show will know by the look on my face how petrified I was. For the most part, I was scared for, and I never expected to get to week 10. And even when I got to week 10, all my husband said was, look, you're on the show now. Whatever you do, don't get kicked out week one, because that would be really embarrassing. Yeah. I was like, thanks.
Sure. They talk about the community getting upset.
Yeah, all of that. And then he says, don't get kicked out week one. So I managed to week
really
by.
This husband of yours is almost like a bit of a mean streak there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But I'd do the same to him. I would totally do the same to him. Yeah.
Nadia, what happened with the Queen's 90th birthday cake? You had to do... Was that a solo project?
Yes. So that
was... That's an incredible thing.
Yeah, so I was out filming Chronicles of Nadia, Do you like the name?
I love the name.
I think it's a good name.
By the way, Chronicles of Nadia was also a TV cookery series, right?
Yes, it was a travelogue and cookery series.
You've done Nadia's British Food Adventure, Nadia's Family Favorites, Big Family Cooking Showdown, and even The One Show, among others.
Yes.
So you're busy doing this Chronicles of Nadia.
And then you get this email and saying, would you like to bake a cake for the Queen? And I was like, no, that's... And I went back and I said, that's a hoax. Somebody's messing around with you. That's not real. And my agent called back. She said, no, that is definitely real. And I was like, okay, I had to take a moment. It didn't seem like... It's the Queen.
Sure.
Slightly shocked. And at the time I was at the tip of the Ganges with no Wi-Fi, watching and waiting, filming with otters and trying to spot blind dolphins at the same time.
They couldn't see you, so you got an advantage.
That's true.
Otters are the coolest things.
All right, let's not get down a trajectory.
Two things. There's only two things I care about in this world, Gareth. You know what one is, and the other's otters.
What's the other one?
Oh, just eating.
It's oh, okay.
Consumed with food at every turn, as Gareth explained it earlier.
So, Nadia, what happens? Do you go to the palace? Where do you go?
So, we went to Windsor Castle, and that's where she was. And it was very... I turned up and I said, look, guys, so I was really nervous, made this cake, and it was less about the cake and more about meeting her.
Did you make it beforehand?
Yeah, so I got back from Bangladesh, totally jet lagged, made this cake.
They don't like let you use their kitchen.
I was legitimately curious about that.
How do you even begin when you get, are they giving you specifics? It needs to be for this many people, it needs to be so big, or do you decide?
She doesn't like pistachios, something like that.
Well, I didn't even ask any of those questions, actually. That's terrible, isn't it? I did ask, are there any limitations? Yeah, what is it? Because you've got to, there's got to be. She's the queen, for goodness sake, you know?
And some people hate raisins. There goes the whole project if you guess wrong on that.
But I think the year before that, the WI had made her a fruitcake. And they said specifically, you can do whatever you like, but don't make a fruitcake. Because they're quite dense. And I think the queen went in to cut the fruitcake and it didn't. She couldn't get the knife through.
Oh, it didn't cut nicely.
Yeah, so they said, could you not make a fruitcake? So I was like, that was it. That was the only guidelines that I had. I was like, that's fine. I don't really want to make fruitcake anyway. So I made her an orange drizzle. So classic British marmalade, orange, just very fragrant and fresh.
That's Ben's favourite cake in the whole world, orange drizzle.
Of course.
Yes, it is.
It's fragrant, it's year-round.
Yeah.
Zesty.
Yeah.
Traditionally okay. British.
It's not
so
too
she's,
heavy.
And she's not, she, you know, no one, who's allergic to oranges, for heaven's sake?
Well, I mean, have you ever seen the Queen eat? I mean, I don't know whether she actually ever ate it.
No, we always see Camilla eat. Of all the royals, she eats the most.
She eats a lot. Mainly anything for her? Because she'll waffle it down.
Yeah, I never saw her eat it.
Gross, people that eat.
They didn't give you any feedback?
No.
Oh, the Queen loved it. Oh, the Queen didn't.
No, but rumor has it. Now, I might be totally making this up, but I'm going to have this because it makes me feel good. But they say, so as soon as she cut it, they kind of whisked it all away. They took the top, the first two tiers, didn't see them. And then the top tier was taken away. And rumor has it that she took the top tier home.
Huh.
I know.
How many tiers were there?
So three tiers.
Okay.
And the smallest tier at the top, apparently she took the top tier home. And, like, in my head...
Philip, this is wonderful.
That's a good accent. That's good. But in my head, I imagine that she sliced that up, slippers on, by the fire, you know, watching Coronation Street.
Oh,
I reckon
an orange drizzle.
Yeah.
Little sneaky piece to one of the corgis.
Don't insult Nadia's cake. It's not for corgis.
No, because they love them and you're giving them a little bite because it's nice. Oh, God's sake.
But I did hear that the Obamas were there the next day.
You just want the
corgis
to be fat,
don't you? I want to transform, yes. I'm trying to assimilate everyone, starting with the corgis.
If the Obamas, maybe she said to them,
"Ew, Michelle, would you like a piece of this?"
That's
orange?
What I'm hoping.
Sure.
I'm hoping because the Queen apparently has a love for Tupperware. So I believe she does. Apparently, she loves Tupperware. It's her thing. So I assume that I reckon she might have put some cake in some Tupperware.
Well, you've got to have things to put in the Tupperware. Exactly. I mean, what good is a Tupperware collection if it's not in use?
So when you've done something like that and you've done all these shows, is there pressure on you to? Kind of what's next? And when a show like this Asian Odyssey comes along where you actually get to put more of yourself and your family story and all of that kind of thing into it, is that satisfying to you in a way that just doing another cooking competition or a TV show or getting other people to do their baking, is that satisfying in a different way?
Yeah, it's not always easy to put yourself out there. I think sometimes you have to question how much of yourself you're putting out there. So there are moments where I've done things and I thought to myself, how much is this too much of me? Because it's all consuming, you know, working in this industry, you do give a lot of yourself. So it's not always that easy, but some things are important. And I think for me, I could have easily done this trip without any cameras or anyone following me. But I think it's really important because there is a generation of first generation British people out there who don't know their heritage and don't know where they come from. And a lot of us can't connect to anything but the food. And I think it's so important to, if you make that, like for me, the reason why I did that DNA test was because it was on sale on Boxing Day. So I was like,
oh yeah,
I got a really good discount. And then
like
I thought,
a one day only thing. Yeah,
so I think it's really important for people who are curious and can't get that information to do it, because the only thing that we can really connect to is the food. And for me, you know, when I went out to those different countries, especially Nepal, of all the countries, I think that's the place I connected to the most.
It's called what, 23andMe or 22andMe? The most well-known. I had the one done and then found out only afterwards that they were only able to check three of my four grandparents' lineage.
So there might be some exciting
stuff. Yeah, I got one quarter unexplored where there still might be like a Moroccan person or an Ethiopian person or just somebody with some cool shit beyond pasty.
Such self-loathing going on here. And psychologically, if we unpack it, we'll be here for years.
Yeah, because I mean, Gareth's so supportive of me on the show.
Yes, I have noticed. I had noticed. He's great for your ego.
So listen, you did also do a show which I think might be interesting to people who also suffer from panic disorder and anxiety, because it was called Nadia, Anxiety and Me, and it was a documentary, right, which you put together. And you've been praised for this by opening up your own struggle to everybody else and making it possible for people to follow you on that journey, even going through to your appointments and so on, and exploring the difficulties of having this panic disorder. I think it's probably useful for people to see that they're not alone in that.
That's
situation.
Amazingly courageous, because my mum has a bit of that, and I know that when you're in the throes of that, it is probably the most vulnerable.
Yeah,
like that's not just vulnerable; that's vulnerable to the power of vulnerable.
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, my question to everyone usually is like, "What does anxiety look like?" Because lots of people always say to me, "You don't look like you have anxiety."
No, you don't look twitchy at all.
No, yeah. You seem chilled as.
People always ask me like, "What does anxiety look? You don't look like you're anxious." But there is no. It doesn't look a certain way. It's different for all of us. And I have good days and I have bad days. I have days when I can get up and do. You know, I can take on the world, and I have days when I can't get out of bed. And so, for me, it was really important to do this documentary. It was selfish because I thought by doing it, I might be able to help myself in getting better, finding some sort of treatment. And I have definitely improved since doing it. But it was really important for me to be able to share my experience, because there are lots of people out there who do feel alone, because it is it's an isolating illness. It's not like when you cut yourself or break yourself where you go to A&E to have it fixed. There is no A&E for mental health issues. And I think the more we talk about it, the less taboo it is. And the more we talk about it, the more real it is. So
what's the current sort of status around that? You never really get rid of it. You're always kind of, it's always looming in the background.
Yeah.
But have you made major progress?
I haven't made major progress, but I haven't had, like, I was having panic attacks at my worst, I was having panic attacks while filming this show. And I was having them almost every single day. So
how does it really manifest?
It can manifest itself in many ways. It can be just, like, it can start off with, I'm not getting out of bed. And it can be moments where, you know, the last panic attack I had, which was between Christmas and now, I've had one panic attack, which is the longest I've been without one. Which is
from almost every day to that is heck progress.
It's really good for me. But it was because I went to the supermarket and I went to get this obscure Asian vegetable, couldn't find it, and that was it.
That's it.
That was it. I was like, right, I've got to go. I'd literally dropped all my shopping and I walked out, sat in the car, had a panic attack. And then came back and did my shopping.
My mum would have them and have no idea. Like, she would just be like, I'm completely terrified. And she would freak right out. And she would be like, there is no... She doesn't know what's wrong, but something is.
Yeah. And it's not just scary for the person having it. It's also the people around you that if you can't understand what's happening.
Or don't know how to help.
Or don't know how to help. But my poor husband has had to deal with so many situations where he it looks like I'm having a heart attack.
And you're telling the person, look, it's okay, nothing's wrong. And they're almost like, I know that. That's the problem.
Yeah, so it's hard, especially when you've got children as well. It's really difficult because for a very long time I hid it from my kids and I wasn't honest about what I had.
I'm just concerned we let you around fires and ovens and things. When you get this is not the best place.
Don't become violent.
Yeah, no, I'm just worried.
I can handle an oven, even with a panic attack.
Yeah. Listen, I think your CV does more than explain that you can handle an oven. Let's be serious for a second here. So it's been a pleasure spending some time with you, Nadia. It really is, and I hope that that everybody will be watching your new show. And congrats to the BBC for doing such interesting stuff, and particularly this Asian Odyssey, because it, as you say, the connection with food is sometimes the only connection some people have to their past.
Exactly, yeah.
So even that dreadful fish stuff you
or
were
to emotional
about,
happiness of any kind.
I mean, you've talked about some delicious things, and then that fish.
The ant larvae.
Remind me.
You lost me at ant larvae. But
I reckon you need to get yourself to the supermarket and go get yourself some shrimp paste.
I reckon I've got
I'll try a shrimp paste. But ant larvae, no.
Cambodia's off my list of places I need
to
go.
Oh, no.
Oh, you've ruined it for me.
No, you're going to watch it.
The stinky fish
on
the river.
But will you watch it?
The people whose kitchen is so stinky they have to float it down the river. Yeah. Are you kidding me?
We need removable kitchens, guys. We've gotten so stinky with our cooking.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is CliffCentral.com.